Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast. This is a show about data networking, and today we've got another in the series of design and build. And this series is intended to be practical. This series is intended to be engineers chatting about real-world things that they've done with the hopes that lessons learned and experiences that we've had will be of benefit to you. And today's topic is moving a data center. So you've been given the task to move a data center from point A to point B or some variation on that theme. You've got to get resources moved from one place to another. And that can be a complicated task. I've been involved myself in a couple of pretty significant projects like that. One was a data center consolidation project where we were moving from a whole bunch of little data centers into one great big data center. And then another was a greenfield deployment. We were moving, it was actually across the street, which gave us some pretty interesting advantages, but it was from a data center we had definitely outgrown very badly to a brand new facility across the street and all the things that were involved in that. And I've got a couple of guests with me today, Chris Church and Richard Alexander, and I'm going to ask each of them to introduce themselves. Chris, let's start with you.
Yeah, hi, good morning. This is Christopher Church, and I've been working in the technology industry since the early 90s, primarily with small and medium enterprise customers, and I do a wide range of things, voice, route switch, virtualization, and storage. I've been through a number of data center migrations over my career, and happy to be here today.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on board. And Richard Alexander, same question.
Yeah, hi. So, Rich Alexander. I've been in the IT business since the late 90s, slightly younger, hopefully slightly more handsome. But, really technical background, work for a number of large organizations doing a couple of huge data migrations and been working in the value-added reseller space. So, I've done a lot of data migrations in my time with, lots of scope for moving a couple of storage boxes from room A to room B versus moving a global financial data center from one country to another. So, been at it for a while.
All right. So I have to ask, you're in the London area. Do you have a particular sort of UK accent that we would categorize you with? Because it sounds a little more, I don't know, musical, something like that.
So, yeah, I have a very peculiar UK-based accent. It's called South African. I was born in South Africa and grew up in South Africa. So, I'm a South African with a slight, as my wife would call it, Essex twang. So it's interesting.
Very good. All right. And if I didn't mention my name, I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. And my blog is ethancbanks.com. And let us get into this conversation. And I'm going to credit Chris having written much of this outline here. I popped into the Google Doc that we shared to prepare for the show, expecting to write down a bunch of notes and found that it had largely been written, which is pretty awesome for me. As I looked at it and went, yep, this makes sense. Yep, I like it. Looks good. And then off we go. So what we thought we'd start off the show with is talking about three possible approaches that you could do for a migration like this. And there's three kind of high-level approaches that you might be considering if you're in this situation. And we'll categorize them like this. One would be the U-Haul migration, where you're basically picking up everything from one spot and moving it into another spot. Another would be a new build-out, where there's pretty much you got a lot of money available to you, and you can do some capital expenditure to build out a new facility. And then a third, which we're only going to touch on briefly, but we want to mention it, would be you might be thinking about moving into public cloud or doing some kind of a hybrid data center like that, where you're going to keep some of your data on premises, and then some is going to get moved out into the cloud, which is sort of a different problem set. But we wanted to mention it since we knew it was going to be in people's minds. So let's start with the the U-Haul migration, the shut it down, move it, and bring it back online sort of approach. I'll just make a few quick comments myself. I've done some of this, and in actually both of the projects that I mentioned in the intro. And the key, or one of the keys there for me, was actually coordinating with folks what it was that they were shutting down, migrating, and bringing back up again, which sounds silly, but the idea is when you actually power those services off, what all just broke because of that, and what is the outage window? Because sometimes shutting things down and bringing them back up, when you shut them down, you realize that wasn't just the X server that did the one thing. It also did these three other things, and so as soon as we moved it, it broke. And there ends up being all kinds of variations on the project that you can take. Well, if we shut it down, I guess we're going to shut these other three things down as well and bring them all over at once. And so it becomes a fairly intensive project management sort of an exercise. Chris, let's start with you. What sort of things have you run into in this approach?
Yeah, well, certainly the dependencies. It's always those little details that seem to come up and bite you when you're going through something like this. So, you know, the dependencies are a big deal. Making sure that you understand, you know, what services you're going to impact, particularly if you're, you know, if you're moving a subset of equipment or something like that. And then the other piece of it is, you know, making sure you know who those stakeholders are, you know, particularly if the environment is a little bit siloed, knocking a service offline inadvertently. You know, you get that call in the middle of the night or something like that. Hey, this isn't working. You may not necessarily have real good visibility into what that is. So knowing who those stakeholders are that you can contact and reach out to them to kind of work through that or to do some additional validation as you try to recover the service or bring it back online.
Yeah. Another point that I saw written down here was this is a physical move. You are literally bringing equipment from point A to point B. And so there's a question of insurance, actually making sure this expensive equipment that you're hauling from one point to another is covered.
Yeah, we ran into that. We were actually moving a data center about 300 miles to a co-location facility in southern Kansas. And we started doing a little bit of research, and we figured out that we didn't have the proper insurance coverage, you know, for the amount of equipment that we were going to be hauling. So we had to get an additional rider, you know, to cover those couple of days that we were going to be in possession of that equipment. And then there's also the physical security aspect of it. We had spent the night in a hotel because it was the migration spanned over, you know, overnight. So we actually had somebody sleep in the vehicle to keep eyes on the equipment as opposed to just leaving it all sitting in the hotel parking garage overnight. So it was interesting, to say the least.
Rich, did you have any major considerations for a physical move like this, the so-called U-Haul migration?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest technical challenge I've always had with a lift and shift migration like this has always been around a service catalog. So being able to sort of like find owners of services and then, you know, also sort of aligning what the technical dependencies are. Because, you know, like you say, whether you're doing a part move or a full move, you are still going to be bringing, you know, services, portions of services down. And so often I've personally found that, you know, first of all, no one has technical ownership of a device, never mind the service that sits on top of it. And no one really understands, you know, like Chris was saying, the technical dependencies as well. So you bring down a server and then what else is going to crumble? A great example being we did a very small rack move, actually. So literally from one side of a room to another, but it happened to contain all of the DDI equipment. And as we brought down the DNS server, essentially this company's entire service came crumbling to a halt.
Yep.
Because no one had actually, you know, bothered to point out that, oh, we actually don't point anything via IP. It's all via DNS. And, you know, we refresh our entries every 5 seconds because of things changing within the environment.
5 seconds. I love it.
Yeah, it was it's a development environment. But for them, yeah, this particular client, it's crucial, you know, what drives their business. So essentially, you know, sort of moving a DNS box brought an entire business to its knees. And it's things like this where you almost can't imagine that problem would exist. They, you know, and it's that, you say, that service catalog and getting guys to really fundamentally understand what are the dependencies if we move this kit.
I'll add to that a kind of a funny story about this whole, I like the way you put it, lift and shift migration. So one of the data centers that we were moving was across the street, literally across the street. We were in an old building and we owned property across the street and it stood up a new, brand new facility and we're moving equipment in that way. Well, I get called in along with a couple other guys because one of the guys on our team had put a bunch of gear onto a dolly and was sitting on the back of a pickup truck holding the dolly and carting routers and switches across the street like that. One of the managers looked out the window and about had a heart attack because he saw this going on. It was a priceless moment. We got pictures of it sent to us in email by the manager taking the picture of this out the window and said, "What are you guys doing? Are you insane? You cannot do this." Mm-hmm. Oh, it's priceless. That's cowboy style right there, boy. That's that's doing it your own way. But you know, in all seriousness, it kind of highlights the point that this is a physical event. This is labor intensive. This is you know, there is physical security involved, as Chris was pointing out. You need to have insurance coverage. And and another point here is that a move like this can take longer than estimated. And Chris, you had wrote that point, and do you have a story around that?
Yeah, I mean, the situation I alluded to earlier, where we were moving some distance. We ran into road construction on the route that delayed us. There were issues getting access to the facility. When we got there, we found out we didn't have everyone on the list of approved people to be inside the data center, so that caused some additional delays. And then there's just the logistic piece of it, making sure you have enough hands to move the equipment. Do you have a dolly? Does the facility have a loading dock that you can utilize? If not, you're going in and out of side door, just little things like that. It's kind of like if you've ever moved into a new house or moved, changed apartments or something like that. It always just seems like it takes longer than it should.
The most interesting point there for me as well is it's the little things. And I think that happens more often than not. In general, I believe that most teams, looking at a migration like this, are very, very good at planning the big ticket items. So making sure, the routing and switching environment is taken care of making sure there's space and power and cooling for all this equipment that they're looking to move. But what never gets factored in is the fact that, they've got 20 or 30 10 gig ports that they basically need to move. And one of those transceivers gets damaged during the move. And then when they get back to the new data center location, guess what? There's no spare 10 gig transceivers. And all of a sudden now you no longer have a network that works. It's always, in my experience, the little things that trip you up with big, like I say, the lift and shift migrations as opposed to the big things. Always the small stuff.
I would agree with that. The little stuff can't be underestimated. It's funny, in one of the projects I did like this, when there's a series of moves where it's happening over, well, I guess maybe this kind of, let's just move to our next point here about a new build out, because I think that's going to tailor to some of my points a little bit better. I mean, you can do a lift and shift, which I guess for you guys, would you describe this U-Haul migration lift and shift as we're going to pick up the whole data center and move it in a weekend or whatever, that kind of an approach?
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Okay. So then, if we say a new build out, what's different about a new build out is you're going from an old facility that's working into a new facility that you're migrating over time into, which is kind of a different setup here. I think the data center project that I spent the most time and was most heavily involved in was like this, where we had done that across the street new build out. So the advantage of having a facility across the street was we could stand up fiber trunks between the two buildings. And so therefore we could effectively extend the physical network from one side to the other without a lot of trouble and with high bandwidth and low latency. So there was a minimal number of concerns there. So I had the luxury of being able to just extend VLANs across the street, migrate layer 3 routing, one VLAN at a time from one side of the street to the other as it made sense to do so, and then shut things down. So as we were bringing services up on the one side of the street and then migrating physical boxes over, we were able to shut down services on the opposite side of the street, the legacy facility, if you will. But it took weeks. I mean, it took a series of several weeks to get this done, and we would isolate an environment at a time. Okay, this week we're going to move X. And so to do that, we need to have, a row of cabinets here and a row of cabinets here. And we need to have these switches all built, configured, and ready to go and plumbed. And we need to have this much wiring in place. And so we actually had a team of guys that were building out cables, and we'd give them a worksheet and say, okay, these systems are moving into these racks this week, and you need to have all of these particular cables ready to roll with labels, just hanging in the cabinet, ready to plug in when they get moved across the street. It was intense, and there was a lot to it, and we had to maintain both data centers connected as one big data center in a sense at that point. Now, I guess there would be different ways to do that. When you guys have done new build-outs, what's the approach that you've taken for this gradual migration sort of approach?
I'm doing one right now that's very similar to what you just described. So we have extended a high bandwidth connection between the existing data center and the new one, which is, it's actually in a co-location facility, but very similar scenario. And
so pretty close by without a latency concern, or?
Yeah, it's just the other side of town, so it's like 3 or 4 miles away. So the latency is extremely low, and we were able to get a gigabit connection between the two facilities on fiber at a reasonable price. And we have an 18-month plan in place, which may seem like a long time, but there's some capital equipment expenditures here involved as well. But we have an 18-month plan where we're going to you know, be gradually moving servers from the on-prem to the colo over that period of time. And so far, it's worked out really well. You know, they've been, the customers have been able to gradually kind of wade into it. There, you know, the customer actually had some concerns initially about how well their applications would function if they were off-premise. They're not really highly technical and not understanding all the bandwidth and latency pieces of it. So this is also kind of working as a little bit of a proof of concept that, yes, the infrastructure can be hosted elsewhere and you can get basically the same end user experience. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the basement.
I think we would categorize a new build out like this as lower risk and higher cost. I was just looking at that point, thinking about that. And yeah, when you can, if you pick everything up and move it at one time, lift and shift, the first possible, you know, attack you could have for this thing, there's a lot of risk involved in that. If I, just virtue of shutting things down, some servers that have been online for a while, are they even going to come back up? You know, and if you're dealing with however many different little problems that come up when you take everything down, bring it back up again, the connectivity challenges and whatever else, then you've got servers that maybe aren't actually booting back up and behaving properly, and so on. There's risk in there to get all that done. Well, you can lower that risk by doing this new build out, kind of the migration strategy, because you only have one small problem domain at a time as you pick up and move, you know, bits and pieces of infrastructure over a, you know, multi-week or multi-month period of time. You know, on the downside, you've got two facilities that you're maintaining, and so there's network complexity there, certainly. Yeah, and we're going to get into more of this in a bit here. I'm running the risk of we're in the intro and then diving too deep. I don't want to do that because we're going to talk more a bit here. But you've got two facilities that you're dealing with. There's money involved in keeping both facilities online, and then there's network complexity, at the very least network complexity, let alone other application level complexity to make those two go during the period of the migration.
Almost, Ed, sort of like you say, you're almost changing where the complexity lives by doing it one way or the other. If you're going for, like I say, the lift and shift way, the complexity is making sure that, you know, more of that, the planning and, you know, pre-testing, post-testing, what does or doesn't work before you've moved, what doesn't work after you've moved. There's a lot more complexity in that space, and obviously sort of around the physical locations. When you look at doing new build out, I think, you know, the complexity moves in towards, like you say, operating two data centers side by side and then, you know, logically migrating services from one to the other. And I mean, we all know the complications that come from extending layer two between data center locations versus, you know, wanting to have separate layer three subnets within data center locations and going up against the server guys who then moan that VM migration's that much more difficult. And you know, oh, but you've got SRM, yeah, but no one's bothered to configure it, et cetera, et cetera. So you're always sort of like, it's that complexity versus risk versus cost triage thing that just seems to be, you know, the standard thing that comes up time and time again when you're sort of looking at any of these migration pieces of work.
Yeah, completely agree. Shifting complexity, I think, is the best way to describe it. Neither of these are easy tasks. There's tons of moving pieces to make them go, and you just, yeah, you reorient where your complexity is if you decide to go with one approach versus the other. Which kind of brings us to our third approach to the migration here. We got a lift and shift or a brand new build out or the cloud hybrid model, which we don't really want to get into too much detail, but we just wanted to mention this because we know it's on people's mind. You know, Chris, you said you've had customers that have been coming at you about this approach, and do you have a kind of a key set of recommendations or thoughts built around this?
We always take a look at, you know, what commodity services are they still running on premise that could be moved, you know, to a cloud-based solution. Email is one of them. I mean, that's kind of low-hanging fruit. You know, if they're still running Exchange on premise, we make sure that they're at least educated on what Office 365 or some of these other off-prem email offerings have to offer and, you know, what the cost benefit is on the.
You're kind of raising the flag. Okay, you're still running Exchange. Why are you doing that? Why don't you just outsource your mail to the cloud?
Exactly.
I think that's as well exactly how I see most of the clients I've spoken to about any sort of cloud migration. It turns away from being an infrastructure-led conversation very much to a application or service-led conversation. What are the services that we currently consume in our organization that we can quickly and easily move to the cloud? And more often than not, you know, there's services around that that ensure that, you know, existing data can be migrated easily, and the guys have worked out all the kinks. Very seldom do you go to a client and say, you know, we're going to move your entire production environment to, you know, pick the cloud provider of choice, because, you know, for them, the risk, the unknowns, the everything is just far too scary in that world. But saying to a guy, we're going to give you Office 365, yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, it's still a big migration, and there's a lot of work involved, but it just makes a lot more sense to my mind for clients.
Interesting you say that. That's been a theme that's come up as I've dealt with folks at Interop, and I moderated a panel where this came up at Interop in Las Vegas earlier this year, where a big question mark was, how many enterprises are even going to have a physical facility of their own to be managing, and should they? Does the cost of doing that make sense, considering what cloud offerings are out there and the fact that core services like email can get outsourced to the cloud? So, I mean, what really do you need to provide internally, and what are your reasons for doing that? And there are many reasons where you may want to actually do that. And actually, we're going to continue on with the podcast on the assumption that you are going to continue with your physical facility, and you're going to work on a migration between one site and another, and then talk around some – now we're going to get into kind of the project planning and execution and the considerations there. You've picked an approach. It could be lift and shift or a new build out or a combination of those, and maybe moving some things to cloud, whatever. You're now at that point, okay, I'm moving stuff. What do we do? And so let's start with planning. Here are the high-level things that we're going to be planning for. And one of those is the facilities themselves, the actual data center that you're moving into. And I like to think of it this way. You've got this big empty shell that you've got to move into, but you've got concerns about what you're moving into that big empty shell. You need to have power. That is a fundamental and basic consideration. And it's not just power. It's conditioned power. It's power in, you know, provided in the right phases. It's power that's distributed in the places you need to distribute it throughout the data center. So there's a power coming from the street into the data center. There's conditioning of that street power. There's now distribution of that power throughout the data center facility across all of the square footage that you've got there, and making sure you've got amps in the right places. And then for those oddball boxes like, you know, giant Nexus switches and big storage arrays that may need unique sorts of power. You know, I need 5,000 amps to come into this box because it's a beast. You know, and getting special lines provisioned for that. HVAC, you need to have your air conditioning able to keep the facility cool for the amount of BTUs you're going to be exhausting into the hot aisle of this facility. How much is that? If you have too much, the building is going to be too cold and you're just burning power needlessly and it's costing you. But you need to have enough to keep up with whatever all you're moving into this facility. So there's a lot of planning that goes into that, and so on. And I could just keep talking, but I've got guests here. So, Rich, did you want to add to that?
I think sort of the only one I would say is, I don't know what it's like over in the US, but certainly UK, Europe, there is a huge mandate to basically make sure that, you know, whatever we're putting into data centers is as energy efficient and as green as possible. Yeah, I mean, we do definitely have a number of clients that are coming to us as experts within our field, saying to us, as you put together a design for my data center migration, and this is obviously, you know, very much around the new build, my new build facility needs to provide the same functions as what my old one does, but it needs to be on the latest stuff that makes sure I'm hitting my energy targets, because, you know, I'm either being taxed or some other type of financial, you know, implications towards that. Or potentially, you know, there are clients out there that if their services don't hit certain environmental targets, they won't get business from, you know, within their field. And that has been a thing that I see taking off hugely around the environmental concerns that these data centers actually pump out.
Chris, unless you're aware of something, I'm not aware of any legal mandate for that. I mean, there's a social awareness of it, certainly. And you've got Google and Microsoft of the world who are, you know, making a lot of noise about energy-efficient data centers, and Google particularly doing some pretty novel things in that space. I'm not aware of any legal mandates, at least in my part of the country, where that's come up. So that's pretty interesting in the UK that that's a thing, because it sounds like, Rich, from what you're saying, there's financial penalties possibly and or incentives to be energy-efficient, and then I guess there's a social concern as well.
I mean, it's very sort of country specific throughout Europe, absolutely. But I mean, there are definitely, you know, organizations. So like I say, you know, HE, for example, the higher education stuff. So universities have a government mandate to meet certain energy targets. And, you know, there is a mandate around IT, for example. So we need to make sure that, you know, anything new hits certain green targets. Same thing for a couple of other sort of European countries, Germany, for example, where data centers need to actively show that they are saving or becoming more energy efficient as time moves on. And, you know, the pressure then falls onto people that are using colo facilities, for example, to make sure the equipment that's going in there is more efficient than the stuff that's getting taken out, for example. So, you know, it's a big concern. And, you know, I think there's a lot of clever things we as network engineers can end up doing to really end up saving our clients quite a lot of money. You know, forget about the social impact. At the end of the day, you know, that they've still got books to balance and they're looking at a bottom line. And by being energy efficient, it's a nice, easy sell because, you know, ultimately we're saving them money.
Hmm. Chris, let me ask you another power-related question. I mean, what is your backup strategy for a physical facility that you're moving clients into?
Yeah, so, you know, generator-type backup is always preferred, but, you know, sometimes not feasible, either based on the budget or, you know, just the physical space required for it. You know, beyond that, you know, the larger kind of room style UPSs will be something that we'll look at. And then if it's a smaller scales type deployment, you know, the individual rack style UPS would also be something that could come into play as well. You know, kind of another note on HVAC and power, I always try to get the facilities people or the contractors involved in that aspect of the build out as early as possible, because it always seems like even the seemingly simple things of, you know, just getting a 30 amp circuit extended from the panel on one side of the room over to an aisle, you know, just over a few feet away can always be, I don't know, take days or weeks to get done.
Yeah, I agree with that. It seems like it's a thing. And yeah, you got to think about it ahead of time, not when you're racking the equipment or getting ready to do it the next day and go, oh crap, we didn't get the power over there yet. Oh, no problem. We'll call them up. It'll be in quick. No, it won't. You got to plan
that. Those guys, particularly the HVAC contractors, they're busy. I mean, their schedules always seem to be extremely full. And
exactly.
And sometimes the components aren't readily available. I mean, we had a build out that we did just about 2 months ago, and we were waiting, you know, 6 weeks on the coil to come in. You know, it's just stuff like that pops up that can really kind of throw your timeline into a lurch.
Another comment I'll make about physical facility, kind of moving on from HVAC and power, is just connectivity into that building. If you're building out greenfield and you've got the luxury of a brand new building, well, then think about how connectivity to the building and the outside world is being done. So, you know, a strategy that I was involved with on one data center migration, we had the luxury of a new building. And so the data center manager that planned this planned to bring fiber in two ways. One was aerial, fiber optic cable strung to utility poles and then brought into the building that way above ground. And the other was underground, where there was a trench drug and armored fiber dropped into the ground and brought into the building underground that way. The idea being, if one or the other of those lines was disrupted above ground, say, by a car crash, a car hitting a utility pole and knocking out the fiber, the underground would be unaffected, and vice versa. You know, a backhoe digging up the underground wouldn't affect the aerials. I've blogged about this. Some of you may remember a post I did in the last few months about a physical diversity coming into a building. I think I was writing about it in the context of SD-WAN. Space requirements is yet another point to be made. How are you planning for your layouts? And this gets into, we actually worked, I don't know what you guys have worked with. I actually worked with a program that allowed us to do floor space management of rows and do a whole physical layout of the facility for where rows are going to go today and then where they're going to go over the next several weeks and then future reservations. Do you guys have any tips on, you know, planning out space requirements for a facility and, you know, what should be in people's heads?
I mean, I've used a product, and the name escapes me. It was a couple of years ago, but same thing. A company I work for invested quite a lot of money in a piece of technology that did exactly as described. So you would basically, in three dimensions, be able to build out your data center space. You know, you could put in everything from power to cooling to where your diverse pods were, to the point where you could even sort of like identify, so on those sort of like inlet paths through the building, identify which particular vendors that you get your services from would have requirement or sort of paths on each of those lines, for example. I mean, it was an amazing piece of technology. It's amazing at just how that helps with, you know, capacity planning for the future. And again, sort of like, you know, trying to make sure you're not creating any hotspots because it did all that modeling. And I think, you know, having a tool like that is really, really useful. So the only thing about it is it's definitely one of those things that you get out as much as you put in. There's no such thing as a quick fix with anything like that, as we all know. You've really got to do the grind to get the info back out.
Exactly. It was the same with us. You had to keep up with it, keep putting the information into it, and then it was a wonderful reference when it was up and running. And if you kept up with it, it was a great database and very helpful, because it not only dealt with physical floor space, but also amp management and some related things like that. It was very useful. So, okay, we got to move this thing along here. I mean, one other point that I'll raise about physical facility is if you get to design it from the ground up, also consider your access to the building, physical access to the building. How are you going to do that? Is it going to be biometrics? Is it going to be a card system or some combination of those two? Are you going to have a man trap in the front of the building, let's say, literally trap those people in who ought not be in the building and are trying to violate the physical perimeter? Are you thinking about walls in between a common access part of the building that might have meeting rooms or cubicle space or a NOC, and then the actual data center itself, where the data center is being housed, and how are those walls being set up so that people can't do simple things like, you know, pop a tile out of the drop ceiling and climb over the top into the data center, which I have heard stories of that exact thing being done. All concerns and, you know, common sense things to be considered.
I'll tell you another great one is to consider whether you want your systems to fail open or fail closed. Because I was working on a client site where the system was designed to fail closed. However, it was an IP-based system, which was then reliant on all the data center equipment sat within that data center. So the particular engineer on site, when the data center went down, was then locked in the building until he could bring systems back up, because he couldn't get out of said building.
I had not thought about that. Oh, and I should add video surveillance too. I don't know if that's come up as it must be. Back in the day, it wasn't always such a thing. Now it's much more of a thing to keep track of different corners of the data center, where can people hide and, you know, not hide. You want, you know, eyes on in the data center at all. The bigger the data center is and the more racks and rows you've got, and the deeper those rows go, the more difficult it can be to get sight lines everywhere that you want them.
And I mean, physical security is, you know, one part of that end-to-end security piece around, you know, data and data centers in general. You can't ignore the physical aspect of your security strategy, because, you know, you are fundamentally then leaving, as you say, the front door open.
Interestingly, I think this is a case for a colo facility, because you can look at a colo facility and find out what their physical security rating is. They'll talk about that in their official standards that they can comply with to demonstrate what their physical security level is. If you have your own facility, it's your own problem to figure those things out. If you co-locate in someone else's facility, well, it's their problem.
Especially if you're trying to meet certain standards, you know, so sort of like there are physical security standards around things like PCR, for example, et cetera, et cetera. And to do them yourself is very expensive. Whereas if you're in a colo facility, granted, you are paying for the privilege of being in said, you know, or such a data center, but, you know, they're spreading the cost amongst 1,000 clients. So it's an interesting question.
Mm. If you work for a company and you build a new facility, you know, engage with your architect. If there's an architect involved that's doing the design work on the new building or whatever, a lot of architecture firms these days, they have specific departments that specialize in not only computer room or data room build outs, but then also how to handle the physical access and the security pieces of that as well. So you don't necessarily have to come up with all the ideas on your own.
Okay, well, let's move the conversation along in this planning section. So we talked through some approaches to the migration. Now we're into the planning phase of the migration, and we've shared a lot of thoughts about the physical facility that you're moving into and the concerns there. We also talked about some of this in the intro section, so I'm just going to quickly mention these to set the stage for what I think is our next major point. But I'm going to say we need to identify and inventory applications and services, dependencies, and then the stakeholders, the business stakeholders, if you will, that are tied up in this, as well as the technical contacts for those applications and services. And we mentioned this in the intro. This is definitely a crucial part of your planning, where you understand not just that you're moving a box or this piece of equipment, because that's almost irrelevant. You actually need to understand at a deep level, if I pick up the storage array and move it, what all services just got affected because I'm moving that thing, and therefore I've got to really move it all together. Or I've got to at least plan to be able to take the storage offline and then bring it back up. There's a lot there. There's a lot there and a lot of time you're going to spend there, because you're going to find, at least in my experience, people in your IT group, there's the knowledge of how the system works is probably spread over a bunch of people. It's going to be the rare case that any one person knows exactly how all of the bits and pieces work together to deliver an application. You may have that person, and good for you if you can find that person and then get on their calendar. So there's a lot of homework that if you're the person actually managing this move, you're really going to have to spend a lot of time to sort out. I need to get this server moved as it's time. That's the exchange box, which is in a cluster tied to these two storage arrays and this backup system, and has this network. Who's running the DNS server on the exchange box? Who did that? That's insane. And so on. You've got to do that level of planning so that you understand when you pick up and move what exactly is going to be affected. And again, we talked about that, so I don't think we need to park there too long, because I wanted to move to the next point, which is communication. Okay, so you've identified all of this stuff. You're going to be moving things along a particular timeline, and there are going to be services impacted. All right? There are communications with two groups of people. There's customers, your end users, consumer of those services that are going to be affected, because they're not going to be able to get at your services very likely unless you've done some planning to handle that. And then you've got team members, people that support that infrastructure, who are going to get paged or who are going to not have access to a system they're used to having access to, or who may need to make plans of their own to accommodate the move, and because they're going to drain compute off of that particular part of the cluster and move it somewhere else so that you can take it down without it affecting anything. You know, that sort of planning and coordination that goes in. What about you guys? Lessons learned with the aspect of communication during the planning phase?
Over-communicate. Seems to be no harm in over-communicating, making sure you get all the information out. Stakeholders, managers, customers, if there's customer involvement here, or services that are going to be impacted. And then also make sure that you have an out-of-band communication method. Like, for example, if you're doing maintenance on the exchange infrastructure, or if you're running enterprise voice, whether it be Link or some other voice application internally, you know, you may not have access to your own email or your own conference bridge setup or something like that. So having a provision to where you can have out-of-band communication, whether it's through group text or third-party conference bridge or something like that, would certainly be crucial during the migration phase.
Even like something as simple as before you go ahead and do the migration, you know, get into the data center and check you've got mobile phone coverage. You know, people just assume that you're going to have mobile phone coverage, so you're going to be able to get hold of someone if you have an issue. But, you know, as you well know, a lot of the data centers, mobile coverage is non-existent or really poor. So little things like that, make sure you're, on the ball.
Exactly. It goes back to the point that was made earlier. A lot of times it's the little things that you take for granted or didn't think of that actually become big problems during the migration. So, and I would definitely agree with your point about over-communicate, Chris. It doesn't hurt to send an extra email. It doesn't hurt to, let people know once again or to, you know, walk around to that team that is going to be affected and go, just reminding you, we're going to be moving XYZ. The move starts at, 3:30 a.m. And just wanted you to be aware. Is there anybody else that we should talk to on your team about this? And they'll, you know, it just doesn't hurt. Yeah. It doesn't hurt even.
It doesn't quite, fit into this discussion topic. But as mentioned previously, it's around that pre-migration testing and post-migration testing. You know, like you say, it's so easy for someone to, during or after a migration, come and talk about an issue or a service that's not working, and people spend ages trying to troubleshoot, where in actual fact, the service hasn't worked for 8 months.
Yeah, good point.
Yes, that is a great point. Yeah, that you actually bring to mind one of the things that we would do during a phased migration is before we'd move a new piece of infrastructure, we would take a look at all the monitoring systems. You know, the NMS, yes, but whatever else was monitoring different parts of the infrastructure as well, and get a status. What's red, green, yellow? What, you know, what's up, what's down, what's working, not working right now? And then that as part of our back in service check, we would validate that all of the monitoring systems looked the same, so that people couldn't come at us and go, "Ah, you broke it during the migration." We could say, "Nah, it was broke before the migration."
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many pictures of SolarWinds red, green, amber panels I have on my mobile phone exactly for that reason, to prove to someone that it was broken before I touched it. So,
really good point. Coordination with vendors is another interesting potential concern you might have. So for example, I worked at a company that had a very deep and abiding relationship with several vendors, but Cisco and F5 on the network side were two particularly, where if we were getting ready to move gear over to the new site, or we had stood up, say, you know, new switches or a new load balancer, and we're migrating services over to it in that new facility, we'd have those guys on at the ready and go, "We are doing this facility. We need to have someone in tech support ready to take our call if we have a problem." And that would usually be a local support rep that could, you know, engage with us quickly, someone technical, and then quickly escalate to, you know, the TAC or whatever if they were unable to resolve the issue for us quickly. But rather than it's 3:30 in the morning and something's not working as expected and you need a person scrambling around for an hour or two and waking people up out of bed to get someone with an answer, that for us, that worked out particularly well. What did you guys run into as far as specific vendor communications and coordination?
I always just say, I work for a partner organization, and anyone that's doing this, I always say just, you know, talk to your partner. You know, they are the people there to help make sure that, you know, they are going to coordinate with the vendors. They've more often than not probably got better connections than you. They'll have engineering resources that you guys can jump on and, you know, leverage. It's all about sort of, you know, getting hold of whoever has got skills and experience in doing this before a couple of times. You know, so when I was still in the end user space, you would do a big data center migration once every 4-5 years if you were in a fast-paced environment that had a lot of moves and changes. Whereas, you know, partner organizations are doing data center migrations, you know, 3 or 4 times a month, and that's probably engineer specific. So really just get a hold of the guys and leverage the experience and let them sweat a bit as well. You know, that's the part and parcel of the partnership.
Huh. As opposed to a partnership just being, you sell stuff for us and we take a cut off the top.
Yeah.
Actually trying to leverage the expertise
We love calling ourselves value-added resellers. So guess what? Sell some value.
Yeah. Exactly. Chris, I guess you're on the VAR side. So did you have anything to add to that?
No, just make sure that communicate with the vendors. Sometimes you can open a preemptive case with them. You know, like you can go and get a case opened up and just maybe get an engineer assigned, and you kind of fill them in on the details of what's going on, so that, you know, if you do need to contact them, you know, Saturday or Sunday morning during the move or whatever, you don't have to go through all the tier one piece of it to, you know, get your case number signed and that type of thing. And then another important thing, and this is, I've been stung by this in the past, is make sure that you have the right level of vendor support. Like, for example, if you're doing the move on a weekend, you want to make sure that you have 24/7 coverage with that particular vendor, as opposed to just 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., you know, weekdays. Had that pop come up.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
And if you don't, you know, make sure you at least have some access to someone that has the corporate American Express card so you can open a paid case, I guess. But yeah, so doing the due diligence on the actual maintenance coverage is also important, particularly in complex moves.
Now, when you guys were doing moves, well, just relate a personal experience here, we always had a specific amount of time that a service was projected to be offline. And the way we would do that is we knew, you know, we would have a certain number of hours, let's say, to get this done, whatever it was. So we would announce to all the stakeholders, this service is going down at this time and it should be back up no later than X. And by no later than X, that window was far greater than what we actually thought it was going to take us to do the work. So if we thought it was going to be 2 hours, we'd ask for an 8-hour window. You know, we'd take as many hours as the business would give us without going, without them pushing back and saying they just can't possibly give us those hours. Because of all that stuff, you never know what comes up that prolongs things. And the hope was always, we're going to have this service up way before the end of the window, but we've got a really long window just in case. Do you guys follow a similar strategy?
Exactly the same.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Under promise, over deliver. End of story.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another one of those things. I mean, I typically start that negotiation, if you will, with the customer very early on in terms of, okay, what kind of window, what's the maximum window that I can negotiate here, knowing that, yeah, there's a good chance I won't need it, but if something really goes sideways, you have that extra cushion, not only to, you know, complete the move and get everything powered back on, but then also to go through the validation piece of it.
And also, I mean, the time for rollback, I think that's always one of the important things. It's gone belly up, or guess what? We need to go back to square one and building in that time within the plan to say, okay, well, we know that, you know, we've got 8 hours to do a change, but it takes 2 hours to roll it back if it goes wrong. So really, fundamentally, we've actually got 6 hours to get the job done and tested and validated.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the point I wanted to make, is to speak to what Chris was saying about things going really sideways. If it just really tanks, and you've just said, forget it, there's no way we can get this done, we got to go back. You have to have time to go back. That takes time too. So there's not, you really need, really budget more time than you think you need. I go for as much as the business will give me, and with that under promise, over deliver kind of an approach. So, all right, some practical things here to consider, some additional, you know, more practical hands-on stuff. Connectivity at the new site. Now, we talked around this a little bit. Like, for example, if you're migrating between two facilities, how much bandwidth can you get between those two facilities to ease that migration? And then another challenge I'll speak around connectivity is simply, let's say you rely heavily on WAN circuits. Does the carrier have the facility to deliver all the WAN circuits into your building, your new facility? And what is their timeline to do that? So one facility that I worked at was very heavy number of carrier circuits, literally hundreds of them, because we ran several large, at the time they were frame relay networks, but had migrated into MPLS. And we needed that carrier to work with us on that connectivity in lockstep with our project. And so they were a key part of our facility management. It wasn't simply we just put in a bunch of circuit orders. It was we had our rep on site with intimate knowledge of the project, what it was that we were trying to achieve, with them involved with their own project managers to determine how they were going to deliver the circuits to us that we needed when we needed them. It was a very big deal for us there. Again, one of those things you just don't want to overlook. In our case, it was obvious. We had literally hundreds of WAN circuits, so it wasn't anything that was going to get missed, you know, during the project plan. We knew it was a big deal that we had to consider. But it is something that you could maybe overlook if you're not thinking it through, just kind of take it for granted. Oh, I'm just going to order the circuit. It'll be no big deal. Well, it could be a big deal, and it could really mess you up if that connectivity is not there when you expect it to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It's not necessarily that you've missed it in the planning stage. It's more about the fact that, you know, say, for example, you have got a particular third-party WAN circuit, and on the day of your migration, they happen to have an outage. well, you know, that's a serious problem for your migration plan. And just, again, having all of those things within the plan about mitigating all of these potential risks and issues, and what's the plan if, you know, said feed is not available on the day. Do you go ahead and, you know, hope for the best on Monday morning when they've rebooted their core, et cetera, et cetera?
I'll ask you guys an opinion question here, because I'm not sure where I stand, but I've experienced both. And that is, in during migration, would you rather do a hot cut with a vendor, or would you rather have them stand up a new circuit that's ready for you ahead of time, and then you just start putting traffic across it?
Generally, I would always go for a circuit to be up and running. I come from a financial services background, so it was always a case of de-risk the project as much as possible, and we'll worry about how much it costs later. So, yeah, given that that's my background, yep. There's always a case of just buy another circuit. If we pay for the old one for 3 months while we, you know, doing our migration, who cares? It's less risky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mean, having the other circuit already provisioned and you know it's operational certainly removes a lot of the risk from the scenario. On the other hand, I have done the hot cuts, and they have gone well. And, you know, a lot of times it depends on the provider that you're dealing with. I mean, there's a particular provider here in the Midwest that I've done a number of, you know, the hot cutovers with, and they have their act together. They've been able to deliver on every one of them so far. So I have a certain comfort level with using them for that when needed.
Yeah, and you guys are the exact same experience as me. I've had really good experiences with hot cuts with a vendor that's right on the ball, understands the account and our requirements, and just gets it done reliably. I've also had things I've had a bad experience with the hot cuts as well, where they just didn't go well. And so for yeah, to mitigate the risk, just pay for the two circuits for the amount of time it takes to do the migration. Yes, it's going to cost some more, but it de-risks the experience, which in certain environments is pretty crucial.
And there are definitely providers as well that you can negotiate that away with. And, you know, you might have to pay for a last mile install if they don't have, you know, stuff in the ground already. But certainly, you know, there's been many occasions where I've done sort of just client migration. So not necessarily our own data center core at the financial organization where I work, but just migrating a client site environment, because we would host infrastructure at the client site. And if they moved, we'd just go up to the provider and say, we need you to put another circuit in for us to do the migration. We're not going to pay for two. You know, we just want the second one there to do our testing and move across. And, you know, generally, a lot of providers were quite happy because, you know, at the end of the day, they're also a service provider and they want to provide a service. So,
Yeah. Another very practical concern we've got is external DNS. So if you're moving from one facility to another, there's a pretty good chance that your external facing IP blocks are going to change, and therefore DNS is going to change once you've migrated the service from old to new. So some real fundamental basics here about DNS is your TTL. If you are trying to do a quick change, you want the transition from the old IP block to the new IP block to be visible quickly to the internet. You don't want stale DNS entries to be hanging around in the cache, DNS server caches of the world for terribly long. Therefore, if you're used to having, say, 24-hour or longer TTLs, you want to reset your TTLs to something very low, seconds or minutes, depending on how tolerant you are, so that the stale entries will fall out of cache very quickly, and the global DNS will pick up on your new IP addresses quickly and begin running transactions against the new IP block just as quickly as you're ready to take them. TTL is another one of those things where if you don't think about it till the day of the migration, you just might have screwed yourself. That might be a bad thing. It's one of those things you got to stay on top of. Do you guys have other points you wanted to make about external DNS?
Well, just make sure you have access to it, you know, particularly if it's, you know, hosted, you know, a third party.
That's a really good point.
You know, the TTL, yeah. There's nothing more frustrating than TTL, but then the other piece that's equally frustrating is when you can't even get access to it to make the change because you don't know who has the password or, you know, the account.
Because it was bought by the marketing department and, yeah.
I'll tell you another one that almost adds to that as well. And I mean, it's certainly not DNS specific, but, you know, if you've got certificates signed against devices that then look at an IP address and that's changed, and then, you know, you wake up on Monday morning and all of a sudden, you know, VeriSign ignores your previously secure service because all your certificates are no longer valid.
You saying that's bad?
It does not help, specifically if you work for a financial services organization.
You're bringing back memories. I mean, I did my time with financial services, and all those same concerns grew up, were there in my mind as well.
I think it's almost a place where if I could have my way, I would have all new network engineers that are coming to our world work in financial services for 3 years just to realize how ridiculously painful life can be.
Yeah, I used to have to do lab exercises and then be able to say, during a spanning tree convergence event between an access layer switch and a core switch, we didn't run a distribution layer at this particular facility, how many frames would be dropped so that they could make an intelligent decision about whether or not it was, you know, how risky the change was. And this was with a fast failover, rapid spanning tree kind of approaches, where in theory, it's the failover link is waiting for you and it would be almost instantaneous. Oh, yeah, just that kind of stuff. We get calls from customers going, we noticed at 2:15 in the morning that three transactions were dropped and we just wanted to know why. What? It was less than 5 seconds. During a 5 second window, you wanted to figure out what happened? Oh, okay.
So you always blame the firewall, right? It's always the firewall's fault.
Exactly. It's funny that we actually had an issue like that with a customer. It came up where that, I'm not exaggerating about that. It was a teeny tiny little outage, but they had somehow traced it to not their infrastructure. They thought it was within our infrastructure. And we found a problem. We actually found an event at the routers on the edge between their network and ours that connected them into our cloud, where there was a configuration problem that we were able to fix. It was actually kind of interesting, but that is the level of concern financial services have. It's not an issue of nines. Well, how many nines of uptime do you have? That isn't acceptable. It's 100% uptime. That's what's acceptable. Anything that's a downtime that could have caused a impact to traffic flowing through the infrastructure has to be accounted for, no matter how minute it is. Extremely stressful because of that during changes. Because there's no way you cannot drop some traffic during any sort of an infrastructure change. Like, that's just the nature of the beast when you're doing a major network change. And so anyway, we're getting off the beaten path here. So connectivity at the new site, external DNS changes we talked about a bit. And then there's a point here about equipment delivery to the new facility, which we talked a bit about in the intro. Don't sit on the back of a pickup truck with a dolly and haul it across the street. You probably want to have something a little more coordinated than that. You know, when you guys are doing long haul migrations, what's your strategy usually?
My strategy is, if I don't have to haul it myself, that's preferable. But, if you're going to use a carrier, obviously that has to be coordinated ahead of time. Some facilities, if you're working with a co-location facility, some of them have certain restrictions around when and how equipment can be delivered. If they have a loading dock, that's always excellent to get access to, but sometimes that has to be coordinated ahead of time as well, particularly if you're dealing with larger pieces of equipment. And then I'm sure you guys have experienced this in certain co-location facilities. They don't allow cardboard on the data center floor. You have to do all the unpacking and whatnot on the loading dock and that type of thing, which...
Yeah, the idea being the cardboard generates dust that then gets kicked around the data center atmosphere, if you will. And so, no cardboard in the data center. I have worked in a facility like that. Yeah, I wanted to, on your point of don't move it if I don't have to, I'm the same way. I mean, I remember being, particularly in my younger days, needing to move equipment, or in some cases just deliver equipment, because I was a VAR delivering equipment for a customer. I'd have more dollars worth of equipment in my car than my car itself was worth. It's like, oh, geez, I hope I don't get rear-ended, because it's going to be bad.
My greatest ever migration story around a particular device in a car was we did a data migration or data center migration for a client where basically all the metadata around a particular service basically existed on a long time ago, but on tape drives. And basically the tape with all the metadata to bring everything back up online as we basically got this new data center up and live was actually in the back of a colleague's car, who had, after all of the migration work had been done, decided he'd had enough and went home. And literally we sat for about 4 hours trying to get hold of this guy to bring this tape back to this data center so we can get our lives back on track. And you were just like, you know, again, coming back to the planning phase, you could never plan for something like that. You could never plan that Joe Bloggs is going to leave the most important tape in the history of the world in the back of his car while he goes for a nap. I mean, it's just impossible to plan for.
That's a very special flowchart exception right there. And if someone doesn't show up with the tape.
Yeah. And the only good thing that came out of that particular experience was that we had someone to buy all the beers that evening.
Yes, exactly. This seems to be on him. We'll have another round, too.
Buying all the beers forever.
That's right. Okay, so as we continue on in the planning discussion, another thing to consider is physical access to the new facility for everyone that's involved in the migration. And that's another one of those things that takes time. If it's a colo facility, they've got to be, you know, validated and verified and probably fingerprinted and, you know, and so on, you know, given maybe a physical key card, the process or numbers, combo, et cetera, assigned to them so that they can get in and out of the building. And they can't just show up on the day of the migration and go, hi, we're here, because they're not going to be allowed in. And even if it's your facility, it's the same thing. You've got to have all your readers and cards and so on lined up and in place so that that's a non-issue. It's less likely to be an issue if it's your own facility, I suppose. But again, one of those things to – you don't want to be thinking of it the day of the migration. Oh, crap, these guys don't have access to the building.
And that's, I mean, it brings up another very interesting point and something that I actually have lived out as well in terms of your logistics company and access to a building. So I had a particular data center migration for a huge financial organization where everything was planned to the minutest detail insofar as that the driver that was moving the equipment from site A to site B had to give his name and the particular vehicle he'd be driving on the day. And of the day of the actual physical move, that particular truck had broken down. So they just picked another truck out of the yard. And when it came to the data center facility, they would not, for love nor money, allow that truck through the front gate because it was not what was on their system as recorded truck for that delivery. And game over, you know, literally to the point where Bob, I have to turn this truck around and come home. What's the plan? And you're kind of like, well, there is no plan, mate. You've got a data center in the back of your truck. We need to speak to, you know, whoever we need to speak to. You know, if it has to be the Dalai Lama, we'll get him on the phone, but it has to get into that facility. You know, again, just ridiculous. The smallest things. I'll come back to that all day long, but I promise you, for every single person that listens to this podcast and has an experience about a data center migration going, as we say in the UK, tits up, it is going to be something small.
Well, so that's a good segue into yet another point, things that you can do to prevent small things from screwing you up. Think through some of the details of what you're going to need to have available to you, just little things that can help you out when you're actually executing the migration. For example, spare cables, have extra rack hardware and tools around if you need to just so that you can give something to everyone that's actually at the migration. So no one's standing around because they don't have a screwdriver with them, something like that. Do you have extra PDUs? PDUs go south, especially if they're managed PDUs. I've been in a situation where brand new PDU, out of the box, plug it in, it won't light up. What's wrong? The control board is dead, and so it won't authorize power to go to the PDU. Useless. If you don't have a PDU that's required, that's another one of those things that's going to hold you up. Or best case, you can plug in half the power, and then the redundant power supply units aren't lit up, and you're sitting there going, don't fail. No one have a failure. No one fail until you get the replacement PDU in. KVM. Do you have a KVM setup available where you need it? You're definitely going to want that for a migration because inevitably some server that you're going to plug in and power on isn't going to work and you're going to need KVM on it to see that it's working. Have at least a couple of crash carts around so that more than one person can stand there with a cart that's maybe got KVM on it or got other things on it that are useful so that you can quickly. It's just a convenience. So you're not sitting on your butt on the floor with a laptop in your lap, running cables up over your head into the rack somewhere. A crash cart is just really handy to have, much more comfortable to work with than trying to work with you know, again, your laptop and you're sitting on the floor, or worse, you're sitting on a cold tile that's blowing air conditioning up your rear end. I've been in that situation, just freezing to death, trying to get something online that wasn't coming up. Flashlights, again, a simple thing, but depending on how the lighting is in your facility, you can't see real well inside of an enclosed rack, and having a flashlight can be awfully handy, especially if you're trying to do things like get rails mounted so you can slide a piece of equipment in. If you can't see what you're doing, it can drive you bonkers. These rail kits all seem to be different. Getting the screw holes lined up properly and getting them fixed so that they're secure is a hard thing, even when you can see. And if it's dark and you can't see, you're just going to make yourself insane. So a lot of those little details that are you plan out can really make a migration go more easily. It just kind of smooth over some of the bumps that you can run into.
I think it's about making as few assumptions as you possibly can. Everything should, you know, try and be tested and planned. You know, a cable, for example, power cables. Don't go in assuming that the 2-meter power cables you have in your existing facility are going to necessarily be long enough when you've moved. Or, you know, the alternative is they're too long and then now they're preventing something from fitting into a rack. And, you know, you've only bought one rack in a colo, but because you've got these super long power cables, now all of a sudden, you know, the last of your server infrastructure won't fit into the rack because there's power cables dangling everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually will try to find shorter length power cables. There are certain places where you can find them as short as 1 foot, which come in really handy for making that short run from, you know, the back of the server over to the PDU. Mm-hmm. Makes it a lot cleaner installation, and you're not dealing with all the, you know, 3 or 4 foot of, you know, AC power cable that you're trying to Velcro and zip tie to the side of the cage so it's not hanging out in the way.
Yeah, better airflow out the back of the cabinet too. If you don't have, you know, these loops of cable that you Velcro it up of excess cable in the way, blocking airflow, it's nice to have cables that are custom length, whether they're network cables, power cables, or other kind of cables. Anything you can reduce length and not keep that excess in the cabinet is nice. Network cables, if you buy prefab, they tend to be too long. Especially if you buy like the 10 gig copper cables, you buy, you know, 3 meter, 5 meter, 7 meter, whatever the lengths might be. If they're too long, I always loop them up on top of the cabinet, which I sort of hate doing too because that's sloppy, but at least it's not in the cabinet blocking airflow.
I think the best piece of advice I ever received when I was a very junior network engineer was, and you know, this goes beyond the physical, this goes to, you know, the logical stuff as well, is design the network for the guy behind you. You know, if you walked into a data center, and I've been into some rooms where you think to yourself, the person who did this must really hate me. He doesn't know me, but he must hate me. Because, you know, you can't even see the switches for the cables. So, you know, always just try and do, say, the physical design for the man behind you. It needs to be easy to, you know, during a switch refresh, get the thing in and out, and see labels if that's appropriate. And, you know, the same thing with just, you know, putting descriptors on interfaces and bandwidth statements, just, you know, all the small details that make the whole thing just look more professional and flow easier, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, one last point we want to raise here in this planning section is this: create a validation plan. And I'll say what that means to me, and then you guys can chime in as well. But to me, a validation plan is when we bring the new system online, these are the things that we know to be checking to make sure that the new installation is valid. It works. It is delivering services. And that would mean, for example, these Ethernet interfaces are up and running and this host name is resolvable. And when we log in, we get this sort of result, and, you know, on down the line. The validation plan is the thing that you don't want to have to figure out on the fly after you've done the migration, because you're tired, you're maybe stressed, you're tense, you're maybe even tired, maybe is too small of a word. You might even be exhausted. And your brain doesn't function very well at that point. And so the validation plan is the thing that you look to that you can follow without having to, you know, figure it out on your own at that point to prove to yourself that this migration is indeed complete and we are delivering the services that we are supposed to be delivering now that the migration is done. What would you guys add to that?
I would say, you know, get the stakeholders involved. You know, like, for example, you know, I can see that an interface is up. I can see that a server's booted and the services are started. I'm not necessarily going to be able to log into the CRM package and be able to validate that every piece of that is working correctly. So having the SME or the stakeholders, you know, that are specialized in that particular application, have them be part of your validation plan. So when you think it's ready, you contact them, have them log in, validate the databases are working correctly, they're able to get to certain applications and that type of thing. It lessens the chance that you're going to get a phone call either first thing Monday morning or, you know, right after you get home. You know, somebody's contacting you with an issue because they can't, you know, they can't get in the database or they can't run their expense report or whatever.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, the validation plan for you is step one. And then, like you say, you've got to get the people that use the applications involved and say, is this working from your experience? And yeah, absolutely. A key part of it for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again because I feel so strongly about it. It's the before migration testing and the after migration testing and making sure it all basically, you know, when you do that diff statement, there are no diffs in the before and after because then, you know, your job is done and it's done right. There is, you know, there is no argument there. It is as it was.
Okay, so that really brings to a conclusion the planning section here. So we talked about some choices in the beginning, what sort of a migration you might be doing. We talked about planning through a lot of practical considerations and concerns and lessons learned among the three of us. Okay, let's assume now we've got a plan together. We know where we're headed. We know kind of how we're going to do it. What are the final preparation steps now? We're ready to make this thing happen here. So what's the final bit of preparation that we've got to do to be able to deliver on this plan? And to me, I'll just speak about it at a high level from my experience. I was usually in some sort of a project manager role. Very network-centric was my focus. But I had people that I had to manage. You're going to configure this set of switches in this particular rack. You guys are going to make all these cables and fulfill this documentation. So in other words, there was a team of people that I had to pull together to fulfill the specific part of the migration that I was largely responsible for. And I, you know, with that group of folks, there was coordination. I had to let those folks know exactly what it was that they were doing so that there was no guesswork. It wasn't fuzzy. It wasn't, well, you know, we're going to move this system over this weekend and, you know, everyone do your part. It was, you specifically are responsible to do these set of tasks on here. So it was not, again, it wasn't fuzzy. It was very specific. It was very regimented. And everybody understood what they were doing and they had the opportunity to ask questions if they weren't clear on what they were doing. And people could say, yeah, but you forgot about X. And, oh, yeah, okay, well then, you know, someone would be assigned that thing that we'd forgotten about. And, you know, getting the team assembled and giving them their assignments was, you know, for me, the, you know, the most crucial, you know, piece of the puzzle. What about you guys?
Yeah, having people standing around and not knowing what to do next is, I mean, it's frustrating for them, but it's also frustrating for, you know, if you're in charge, you see somebody standing over in the corner and, you know, they're not really quite sure what to do, that, you know, that also takes up your time, you know, trying to coordinate, you know, the different resources on the fly. So having the team assembled, but then also having that, you know, a very specific plan outlined in terms of, okay, these are the steps and this is the person assigned to that step. You know, it gives them ownership, but then it also gives them an opportunity to maybe do a little due diligence or a little discovery ahead of time to make sure they completely understand what's expected of them. And then they have an opportunity to ask questions about that before the actual day of the migration.
I would put a timeline on that as well. So, you know, if it was, you know, there was an expectation it was going to take 4 hours to get things done for this particular part of the migration, I would say, all right, so at, you know, X time of day, we begin. And then 25 minutes in, we expect to have hit this milestone. And then by an hour 15, this milestone, you know, and so on. So that everybody kind of had an idea of how quickly they needed to move along and the focus they needed to maintain to keep things going. And it was also a good indicator of when it's time to call it, this isn't going to work, we got to back out or roll back. If the timeline is just, if you're just not even close, you kind of know, okay, things didn't go well. We're going to have to try this again. So I felt with that specific plan, the time was, a timeline was pretty critical as well.
No, agreed.
So peer review is another thing here that I think is pretty key and that I certainly would do as well. If you are used to being the technical team lead, let's say, and kind of everyone's looking to you. Maybe this isn't obvious, but it's always good when you get your plan written to have other people look at the thing and tell you what's missing. You see things from your point of view. Other people see things a little differently, and so by giving your plan to someone else, it's much more likely they are going to catch something forgotten or a mistake or notice a dependency that you missed. And so I think peer review is really key. I mean, how many people would you guys have review your plans?
I would basically come down to the complexity of the migration. Anything, you know, simple enough, you kind of want a colleague to pass an eye over and give the general okay. But, you know, so for example, we did a very large migration for a company that moved essentially an entire data center location from the UK to the US, specifically to sort of meet some financial trading standards requirements. And that data center migration plan probably went through, I would say, 30 iterations and well over 100 reviews. And it's just the nature of the migration, you know, it's got to be what's the clever number or what's the right number for the complexity and, you know, certainly the value of the service involved within the migration. I don't think there's any sort of like right answer to that. It's got to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. If your boss comes and says, well, you need to send that to your 30 of your colleagues, and you're like, well, hold on a minute, I'm moving the DHCP box from, Vancouver to Toronto. I think you've probably got your wires crossed at how important that box is, yeah. For example.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that being said, you certainly want to give it wide enough distribution for peer review that the right stakeholders have an opportunity to throw a flag or raise their hand and say, okay, wait a second. You're doing this at the end of the month. Did you realize, you know, we do month-end close, you know, that type of thing. It's just stuff like that that, you know, us of a technical mindset might not think about, but you know, somebody handling the financials or whatever is certainly going to be very concerned about.
Yeah, and I'll point out that this isn't about, you know, your pride or ego or being, you know, criticized. I mean, I think some people say if I do this plan and I miss something, then there's egg on my face and I'm going to be embarrassed and that's a bad thing. No. It's just the reality is in any sort of a complex migration like this, even simple ones like, you know, moving a single server or some such can be complicated and have elements to it that you didn't think of, not because you forgot or were absent-minded, but you didn't even know was a thing. And it's just smart to raise that flag and let other people know. I think sometimes engineers tend to be introverts by nature, and so we don't want to have to engage other people. We just want to kind of do it and hope no one notices. And in any sort of a migration like this, that can be a really bad strategy. So again, that peer review and having other people in the business review what's going on and being aware just makes everything go much more smoothly, even if it means on occasion you have to reschedule. I had this all planned and the stakeholders saw it. And like you said, Chris, month end is happening that weekend. So they really want us to move it ahead, you know, a couple of weeks. Well, that sucks for you, but not for the business. And so therefore, you got to kind of get your mindset correct about what that peer review is really all about.
And Chris raised a good point as well about, so like you say, casting the net wide enough to make sure you catch the right fish. But also, I think from experience, and it will come with experience, that you'll know when someone is being overly disruptive or being a bit too, you know, risk averse to this. There are definitely people that will try and stop the change from happening no matter what. And, you know, it's kind of up to the network engineer, because more often than not, these are network engineering projects to say, you know, it's got to be done. You need to draw a line at some point to accept a level of risk. We can't plan for everything. We're not going to be able to mitigate every single, you know, risky scenario. We just need to get to an acceptable level that everyone's comfortable and get it done.
Yeah, and I've been in those situations, and it comes down to managers have to make the call and talk to each other at that level a lot of times to drive it through. But because you're right, there is no matter what going to be some level of risk involved. And so that's got to happen. And so the change has got to happen no matter what. And it's up to managers to sort that out between themselves or among themselves and make it go. So when you guys are preparing, you're right on the cusp of actually getting ready to do this thing. What other concerns do you have or considerations in your preparation stage, you know, the last little bits of things that you do before you actually go ahead and execute?
Yeah, communication again. We've brought that up a couple of times, but keeping the word out, over-communicating. And it seems like, at least in my experience, the communication piece is what kind of builds the relationship or the connection between, you know, you and the stakeholders or the end users. And when you have that relationship, they're a lot more likely to maybe cut you a little bit of slack, which is always nice, you know, when you're working through a complex scenario like this. So having that relationship and that communication back and forth, everybody knows what's going on, even if it doesn't directly apply to them. And it just gives everyone a sense that they're connected and maybe a little bit a part of it. It makes your life a little bit easier.
Encouraging the, you know, we're working together as opposed to what a lot of businesses seem to have an adversarial relationship with their IT group, where it's like, those guys are in my way and they're expensive and they hold me prisoner, is almost the way that the business stakeholders seem to feel. If you've got that personal relationship with them and you're there to be helpful and not a roadblock and just, you know, coordinate with them closely because we're all in this together, it definitely does foster a better relationship and a better process that you have when you're doing the migration, for sure. Okay, so we've talked through some strategies. We've talked about planning. Now we've talked about preparation, you know, those last things that you pull together to actually be ready to execute your plan. So now we're at the point of actually doing an execution. And Rich, let's start with you. When it's day of, you're getting ready, you're doing the migration here, it's the day, time to execute. What's your process?
Yeah, Chris has put down the points really succinctly, really, and I think it does come down to that last minute check that everything's in order, everyone's got their ducks in a row, everyone's on the same page, you know, the channels of communications are open, you've got, you know, the right stakeholders available where and when you need them to be. And I think as well, sort of, certainly for me, it's about getting the team that's involved in the migration kind of in that right mindset as well. It's a pressure situation. There's very seldom I've gone into a data center migration project where people haven't felt, you know, real pressure. It is serious, you know. There's a lot of, more often than not, a lot of money at stake, and you know, these IT systems are critical to organizations, whether they be big or small, and just trying to keep everyone at ease, really, keep the mood light and stuff like that. It sounds ridiculous and it sounds really woolly and fluffy, but I genuinely believe trying to just, you know, set the precedent as like the leader that, you know, this is going to go well, things are going to be good, you know, everyone's motivated and, you know, we'll get this job done, and afterwards we'll go for a nice steak dinner and a beer. It just keeps everyone, you know, at ease and keeps the tensions off. And, you know, you're going to hit challenges. So, you know, just build that little support structure for the team.
I'll add to that, you know, first of all, the mood is pretty key. Particularly if you're in a leadership role, which we know from people that have responded to the survey, a lot of you that listen to the show are exactly that. If you're super stressed and really, you know, bugging out, everyone else is going to feel the same way. If you seem confident and, you know, just things are going well and you're cracking a joke once in a while, it sets everyone else at ease and makes them more able to do their job. Another element during the actual execution plan, you know, you're actually doing this thing, is communicating with management. You're going to have a panicky manager in a lot of cases who is really fretting about how this process is going, and, you know, because they don't have any control over it. You're the engineer. You're the one that understands how the system works, and you've done all the detailed planning, and you've got your code ready to go and your process. And a lot of time. I mean, maybe it's a technical manager and you've got one of those folks who can actually be helpful in that situation to you during the day of. But if it's a manager who doesn't have that technical background, they have no control of the situation and they know it. And they also know that the business is very dependent on this process going well. And so they are at a very high anxiety level. So having a reach out to them during the day and saying, hey, things are going okay, or we ran into this problem, but we're going to have resolved it pretty soon, or just whatever, keeping them in the loop and letting them know things are going well, or even if things aren't going perfectly, that things didn't go perfectly, but it's under control, or that's going to be good for them and important for them, particularly if they are the ones reporting to even higher up management the status of things and how it's going. It lets them feel like they're adding value, and it keeps them from being needlessly in your face, if you know what I mean, because you're communicating effectively with them.
Absolutely. Well, exactly. It's all about information, isn't it? People are always at ease. We've all probably been on a train that has broken down somewhere, and you know the tension builds and everyone gets really annoyed. Yet if the driver comes onto the intercom every 15 minutes and says they're stuck at a red signal, or as in the UK, it's the wrong kind of heat today, or it's the wrong kind of snow today, you know, people generally get more at ease. It's about having that information just being fed along all the time. Don't micromanage. You know, you've done your planning, you've done your preparation. People know what they need to do, but you know, if it all goes really wrong, fine. That the time to start potentially doing a bit of micromanagement will exist. But generally, just let people get on with it because you know they know what they're doing.
Exactly. So I guess once again we've brought up the point of communication, you know, and even over communicating. And I guess if you're in the middle of a change, you don't want to be having to think about that too much. But it's always good to keep that communication going, even if you don't want to, for sure.
Designate someone to be the communicator. Designate someone to be responsible for sending out the updates. And, you know, that may be you if you're the lead on the project, you know, or, you know, maybe if you're working with a network operations center or something like that, maybe they're responsible for sending out the updates. But make someone responsible for it, set a timeline for it, and then stick to it. Like we said earlier, just even that periodic update lessens the tension to the situation, just gets everybody a sense that, okay, things are moving along, it's all good, I'm still getting updates, just gives everybody an opportunity to relax.
I think another great example that I've got, you know, past experience is, you know, we had a migration that went very badly wrong. Incredible increase in pressure. You know, I had a CFO at my desk explaining the situation and the potential financial implications of not having the systems back up and running. And I think what can happen there is basically the business then gets bogged down in requiring information and not allowing you to get on and get things fixed. And that is the most important time to have that designated information person who can do all the communication, but then you've still got people in the back end that can actually just, you know, get their fingers bloody and fix things.
The best IT managers that I've worked with have been those who have facilitated that. Hey, I know you're under pressure and need to get this done, so send anyone asking you questions to me and I will take that burden off of you so you can focus. I've had other IT managers who've run and hid in an office behind a closed door, literally, not answer their phone, not respond to their door, hiding in their office during an outage. It's like, I need you, man. Come on. I need you to help take some pressure off, and I'm fielding all these questions. But they couldn't take the stress of it.
Yeah, I don't know what the podcast attitude is towards French, but I always say really what you need is someone to stand in front of the fan and take the shit.
That's a good way to put it.
Indeed.
All right, so we've gotten this thing done. It's been executed, and now the last step is that validation, which we've mentioned before here, so we don't need to belabor it too long right now. But again, that last step is you as an engineer think you're done. And you think you're done because you've gone through a list of validation checks that you've gone through. You've checked the boxes. You know that everything is up and running because you've done that part. However, is the application, is whatever other things you want to test, is everything working as expected? So I think, Chris, you brought up an example earlier. can the people who manage the CRM system, let's say, actually log in and do a transaction? You know, does everything look good to them? You got to engage the stakeholders at that point and tell them, I think I'm done. As far as I know, I'm done. Do you guys think I'm done? And tell me your experience using this. Can you verify this is working? Can you verify that is working? And have them give you the thumbs up or the thumbs down, and then dig in from there.
Yeah, to Richard's point earlier, doing a migration like this, I mean, you get blamed for everything that's broken for weeks thereafter unless you get the stakeholders involved and have them come in and actually validate their pieces of it. And, you know, you have to do a little due diligence on your end as well. You know, whether it's the screenshots out of SolarWinds that shows that service wasn't working before the migration or whatever it is. But, you know, you don't want to have yourself in a situation post-migration where you're constantly defending everything that either actually isn't working or is perceived to not be working. You don't want to be the default gateway of blame for everything. So, and a good way to short circuit that is, again, just to get the stakeholders involved in the validation phase.
I'll also add to that, that your validation plan does need to be pretty thorough. For example, one of the things I, as a younger engineer, never really checked but grew to appreciate as something that had to be checked was something as simple as Ethernet links. Did everything come up? Well, this is back in the day, but did everything come up full duplex on both sides?
Yeah.
Are any brand new optical interfaces throwing errors? You know, that kind of stuff. I mean, take nothing for granted. You know, be very thorough about things like routing adjacencies. Did every routing protocol have the same number of adjacencies afterwards as before? Are redundant paths actually redundant still? Things that, if everything's working, unless you have it on your validation plan to validate, you could overlook. Things like Ethernet links, I go back to, because that's the 3 weeks later, the system seems kind of slow sometimes. I'm not really sure why. And then you dig in, you're like, oh, oops, you know, a bad interface because something just got missed during that migration phase. So you really do need to put some effort into that validation plan and have it be quite thorough so that you, as an infrastructure person, are confident that what has been migrated to is indeed 100% good and able to support the applications. Well, okay, so one last thing. Any more points you guys wanted to make, lessons learned, just stuff you want to kind of throw in the mix here as we bring this rather lengthy podcast to a close?
You know, as far as lessons learned, doing a post-mortem on any major project or migration or whatever, I think is always good. It gives your team an opportunity to learn what they've done well, maybe pieces that didn't go well. It gives you an opportunity to reflect on your planning process, you know, fill in any gaps in that. Next, if you have an opportunity to do it again, you can apply those lessons learned to the next time and smooth out some of the bumps.
Rich, anything to add?
Not really. I mean, we've actually covered an amazing amount of information within the podcast. I think it's it's been good actually, because it's been sort of very non-specific. It you know, we're not worried about sort of, you know, the layer three type stuff or layer two. It's really just been about planning it out. Just listen back, pick up the good hints and tips. I mean, yeah. I mean, Chris, your plan you put together, and I really hope, Ethan, that this plan is something we can distribute to guys to have a look at in text. But I think it's excellent. I think there's a lot of value there.
So what we're talking about here is the fact that the three of us have been working off of a shared Google Doc, and this Google Doc that we've been working from to record this show will be at packetpushers.net in the show notes for this show. So if you're interested in all the things that that Chris put together and we've only, you know, slightly altered and then added to as we've recorded, are here for you. So you'll have the high-level points of all the stuff to think about that we've talked here. And maybe you could use it as a basis for your own planning.
The only thing I'd say, Ethan, again, is like I said before, is that, you know, if the guys are going out as a client looking to do a data center migration by themselves, just, you know, tap up your friendly vendor, your friendly, your partner organization, and leverage their experience, because certainly for my mind, doing it that way prior to being in the actual partner space made a huge difference, because, you know, the guys have done it all before. You can hear from, you know, like specifically the stuff that Chris has been saying. He's got hundreds of nuggets of information that, you know, I would have missed if I tried to put together this plan as well. It just goes to show how this collaborative way of working is absolutely worth its weight in gold.
And this brings us to, I think, the close of this Packet Pushers podcast, number 4 in our design and build series on moving a data center from one place to another. And let's go around the table one more time. Starting with you, Chris, would you just remind folks how they can follow you on the internet, and if you have a blog, how they could find that, and so on?
Yeah, sure. So I am on Twitter, fairly active. It's layer_3 on Twitter, and don't do much blogging, but yeah, look me up on Twitter and put some snarky comments out there every once in a while.
Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to come on the show and record. And lucky for us, your little meeting got pushed back so we could spend even more time recording. And once again, thanks. And, you know, for everyone listening, Chris was behind the sequence that we followed here. As like I said in the beginning of the show, I popped into the Google Doc to start building this outline and find out it had been done. That was pretty much Chris. So thanks a lot, Chris. This has been great. And Rich, same question.
Yes, so pretty easy. So if you want to follow me in a professional sense, the Twitter handle is RA, that's Romeo Alpha, and then Logicalis. So RA Logicalis. If you're far more interested in racing antics, be that cars and bikes, you're welcome to follow my personal Twitter feed, which is type, T-Y-P-E dot, or T-Y-P-E-R-G-A. So that's T-Y-P-E-R-G-A. And also sort of anything, sort of if you Google Richard Alexander, I put together a couple of articles in a couple of publications here in the UK. So you'll see the kind of stuff that I'm looking at these days.
Thanks a lot for coming on the show, both of you. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. And this has been the Packet Pushers podcast, which you can follow on Twitter at Packet Pushers or visit PacketPushers.net for this show and several other shows that we've got going on. The Priority Queue show, where we deep dive on niche topics. The Data Knot show that I've launched with Chris Wall, which is about data center design and implementation. Not just networking, but everything that goes into a data center. And Citizens of Tech, which is kind of fun, that I record with Eric Sutphen, where we talk about all kinds of nerdy things. And several of you have told us it's your one must-listen podcast these days, and we appreciate the feedback on that. Again, packetpushers.net. If you have any questions about this show, you can email us, packetpushers@gmail.com. We don't promise to respond immediately, but we do promise to respond just as quickly as our schedules permit. Last but not least, remember that. Too much networking would never be enough.